The U.S. military has been called upon historically to do the nation's business around the world. That is, the military, among other things, being an instrument of humanitarian work and the like, but among other things, is intended to and has done well at executing the mission of ensuring security around the world for the flow of commerce, for the welfare of people, so that migrations are avoided, so that mass famines can be avoided. The change in the climate, the new and unexpected conditions that people around the world are facing contribute in a variety of ways to the stresses that failed states and failing states have already in providing the services necessary for their people.
We think about one as an example. I didn't think about this. One former military leader had told me, well, look at Syria as an example. And we think of it as the civil war and ISIS is there and a lot of different countries right. are involved. But really, a lot of this started because of intense droughts brought on by climate change and people having to migrate within their country.
Exactly. The government of Syria, which 10 years, 12 years ago would not have been considered to be one of the failing states in the world, was nevertheless having difficulty providing services to its citizens in its big cities. And then a prolonged drought, 7 years or more, coupled with some failures of product in Russia and elsewhere that raised the price of bread in particular and contributed to the Arab Spring. In Syria, the drought drove something like 1.5 million farmers off of their property and into the cities where the government, as I said before, was already having difficulty providing services. So the stresses that already were there between the people and their dictatorial government were aggravated by the conditions that they found due to climate change. There's no doubt that the drought was one of the consequences of a changing climate.
All right, Admiral, let's talk about our military bases and national security. Coming back to this country, I mean, we have bases, the U.S. has bases all over the world. When you look at here in the United States, here in Florida, we have the Florida Naval Air Station in Key West. We used to have a base in Homestead.
That's, sure.
What do you see as some of the challenges that these bases are going to face? What's the threat to them?
This is really an important factor, Lewis, in national security. The base structure of the United States military is absolutely essential to the generation of readiness. The fact is, when we send forces to do the nation's work, they come from places where they've had the opportunity to train, to rest and recover from previous operations, to be recruited, to be equipped. Those stateside bases are invariably, we think, under threat from the consequences of climate change. If you look at the East Coast of the United States and the Gulf Coast, the Union of Concerned Scientists several months ago produced a report that said 18 U.S. military installations, not just Navy, but Air Force, Army, and Marines as well, were threatened by sea level rise. There have been conditions brought about by the changing climate across the country that have degraded America's military's ability to train. For example, in the West, wildfires and brush fires have been far more common, and the season has been longer. As a matter of fact, in some places, the fire season is now almost a year long, where it used to be just several months. The use of live weapons in those areas in training has been severely restricted. Here in South Florida, the time that the base commanders have to devote, understandably, to contending with the new challenges of a changing climate and a rising sea will be time that has to be taken away from other essential military functions.
So it sounds like, I mean, bases now have to consider resiliency the same way that cities, like the cities of South Florida, have to. Is how do we build up to the oncoming rising sea level or these other factors you mentioned?
Well, the bases as a group have undertaken this challenge. I think for every service, I'm most familiar with the Navy, but the Naval Installations Command, which oversees all of the Navy installations worldwide, has undertaken a resilience program. And it encompasses not only that part of the base that's inside the fence line, but it's also intended to be collaborative, cooperative with the surrounding community, so that the steps that are taken to improve the resilience of the base itself to as well produce its own power when that's a piece of the strategy that needs to be implemented to improve resilience, where the benefits of that can be shared with the surrounding community, because after all, it is one organization and the people who surround these bases are very much supportive of the military's mission for generating readiness.
And we talk about, you know, these weather systems that are impacted by climate change, hurricanes, of course.
Sure.
As we come upon hurricane season again, I talked about Homestead Air Force Base 25 years ago, decimated like much of Homestead, much of South Florida because of Hurricane Andrew. It's now an Air Reserve base. How have the bases of any of the branches adapted in the Gulf Coast area and along the eastern seaboard to hurricanes, as we've seen more hurricanes now earlier and later in the season? Not so much more storms, but more intense storms. Now they're moving further north than before.
Sure. Well, there are new construction standards, as you might expect. And so when new things are being built, they're being built with a greater threat from hurricanes in mind. It's not just true on the East Coast, but it's true on the West Coast too. And some of the most severe hits from hurricanes have been encountered in Hawaii, and certainly the Western Pacific bases, America's installations in Okinawa and mainland Japan, the Philippines, elsewhere, have all been hardened in some ways to confront the challenges of hurricanes. But the bases in South Florida face the same challenges as these municipalities, as the cities and county in South Florida. And so what I saw over the last couple of days when I've had the privilege of talking with citizens here who are involved, who are thinking ahead about what South Florida faces, I've been impressed by the collaborative effort. And I know that what's being learned by the municipalities and the civic leaders in South Florida is being shared with the bases as well, and vice versa. I know the bases are encouraged to do that too.
I'd imagine every base is a target to any enemy, so there has to be some level of protection or preparation for an attack. How do leaders look at storms and, again, rising seas and, again, all of these other natural challenges that you're going to face that are getting worse and worse? Do you view them as the same kind of level threat as an enemy?
It's definitely another foe, and it requires depth of preparation. You know, in many cases, one of the great aspects of preparing for the onslaught of extremes of weather contribute to hardening the base in a physical security sense with regard to other threats too. So anti-swimmer, looking at these things from a Navy point of view, the anti-swimmer and limpet mine threat and the like, ensuring that you have greater control over the ocean area that is important to you as a naval base commander, or the surrounding area and the airspace if you're an air base commander, in order to be not only aware of what is going on at the time of the onslaught of a storm, but using those same mechanisms to determine what's going on in your airspace or sea space when there's a potential attack. All that stuff works very nicely together.
You think about, again, what the military has to do after when it deals with a storm, really what happens after a storm, or again, these migrations that may occur because of droughts or again, excessive rainfall, flooding, and so forth. I look at some cases in particular. I mean, we had Hurricane Andrew, Hurricane Katrina. There was Hurricane Maria recently in Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the Navy had to be involved in these, in helping these areas afterwards in the crisis. Have you seen a change over the years in the involvement and that level of involvement after massive storms or any natural disaster? And what kind of, I guess, what toll does that take on our, again, preparedness?
Sure. A number of us, let me go back a couple of years. A number of us for several years have been talking about the importance of recognizing that humanitarian assistance and disaster relief is an actual mission of the U.S. Armed Forces. For decades, it was considered that during the Cold War, if you were capable of going toe-to-toe with the Soviets, that you would naturally have developed all the capability that would be necessary in terms of assisting in the event of a natural disaster. And we demonstrated that around the world often, and at home as well. And at home, of course, the Guard is an extraordinarily valuable and powerful resource in helping in that way. And they've proven that they can function very effectively around the world as ambassadors of the United States in humanitarian assistance, too. And they've done that shoulder to shoulder with the other members of the armed forces.
So these kind of missions, again, where you're going in to help and assist an area, community, a geographical region that's been impacted, do you see these missions increasing in volume?
I do.
So it's again, the climate change is changing so much right now. It's happening right now, and it's forcing the military now to stretch itself out even more.
That is absolutely the way I see it. You're right on. You know, we talk about climate change in terms of average temperature increases. But I think what the military is seeing, certainly what I'm seeing in military operations, is increases in the necessity of response far out of proportion to the relatively small increases in average temperature that we've experienced so far. And that's because the average, of course, is the result of the extremes. You've got a greater storm intensity and frequency. You've got greater episodes of cold in the Arctic. This last winter, there were several days when the temperature was above freezing. It hasn't happened in recorded history before. And so it's not only extreme heat, it's not only extreme storms, it's not only extreme cold, but they result in each one of those has its own challenges.
Again, I'm talking with retired Vice Admiral Lee Gunn. He served in the U.S. Navy for 35 years. He is on the board of directors of the American Security Project. It's a nonpartisan organization whose mission is to educate the public about the changing nature of national security in the 21st century. And he's been giving talks about national security threats, of course, impacted by climate change. So what do you think about? You're looking at this from, again, from that a very interesting perspective, but you also have seen how this topic has been politicized and it is polarizing and it is debated over and over again on television and with politicians. So, I mean, what do you think when you see that, and how do you maneuver through those kind of conversations?
Well, that's a great question. I think it's a horrible waste of time to argue about these things. I think that the science is absolutely conclusive. I understand that there are some people who don't see it that way. But the way I look at this, Lewis, is what's the cost of being wrong? I mean, suppose you adopt my position and say that not only is the climate changing, but humans are some or most or maybe all of the reason that it's changing this fast. And we do something about it. We not only adapt to the extent we're able, we establish seawalls, we rebuild the natural defenses against the sea in areas where they've been eroded. We do all those appropriate things. And then, at the same time, we transition, and maybe even lead the world, as we should, in a transition to advanced energy. Now, sure, I think transitioning to advanced energy is going to have tremendous benefits in mitigation. I think reducing our carbon footprint is very important. That's not the only reason to transition or lead a transition to advanced energy. There are health benefits because we lose 31,000 Americans a year to diseases associated with the atmosphere.
So you're saying your argument is, as many, it's like, well, if we do it our way, but if we're wrong, still there are advances and advantages to
right.
it. Okay, how about this? I mean, our Commander-in-Chief, President Trump, has consistently denied climate change. He even called it a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese. How does this steadfast position by the highest levels of office directly impact the efforts that you've been telling me about by the military? Your Commander-in-Chief isn't buying into it the way you are.
I got it. You know, one of the great things about our democracy, Lewis, is I don't have to agree with anybody. I don't have to agree with the president. And since I'm no longer in uniform, I can even say I don't agree with the president. The military is taking, I think, prudent steps to ensure that it is fit to fight. And that means we have to going back to the naval installations, the Army air bases, I mean, the Army bases, air stations and the like, that we have to protect those because they are the places where readiness for the American forces is generated. We have to build our relationships with communities. We talked about that earlier, because that contributes to the base's readiness to do its work. But it also, in my estimation, has a favorable, very favorable impact on both adaptation and mitigation for climate change. Those are things that, fortunately, Secretary Mattis sees as a military necessity. The other commanders in the Defense Department do as well. And, you know, truth be told, the administration appears to have given the services latitude to do that. And I think that's the right thing to do.
Last couple of things I want to ask you. Let's go back to you brought up mitigation. So it's not just about building resiliency for the bases and making sure that we protect our assets all over the world. And again, in protecting them, we are keeping ourselves prepared and ready. But the military's the mindset is going beyond just that. It's also looking at mitigation. And you keep bringing it up. We're also part of these communities, so we have to work with them as well. What role do you see the military playing in that mitigation? Because you have the leaders of these communities in South Florida talking about that
right, all
the time.
I think partly it's leading by example. Also, I think that the military can and is can foster and should foster research and development in technological approaches to mitigation. Advanced energy takes lots of forms. I realize that there is that nuclear power in South Florida is not without controversy, but the Army has seen the need, for example, to examine the technologies associated with small modular nuclear reactors. If we look back at our experience in Afghanistan to this point, where we lost, the most dangerous thing soldiers and Marines could do was escort a convoy. Convoys were 85-90% liquid. They were carrying mostly fuel and some water. The most exposure to risk that we gave to our soldiers and Marines was moving fuel. If we could put a small modular nuclear reactor in a forward area and provide power there, we would reduce the risk to our soldiers and Marines. And so on the front lines, the services are talking about moving in that direction. At home, the other ways of generating power, fuel cell, electrical generation, solar, wind, all of those things we believe play a role. And leading by example, as well as investing in research and development and being welcoming to new technologies for the generation of electricity and for the reduction of carbon, I think are both positive examples.